Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Brian Hackney, CBS 5 television reporter and your moderator for the program today. And it's my special pleasure to introduce our guest, Simon Winchester, noted author, whose latest book is Skulls, an exploration of Alan Dudley's curious collection. What's curious to me, and always has been curious to me, is how Mr. Winchester picks his next topic. They're all over the place, and every one of them is fascinating. And again, it's one of those topics you'd think, I wished I had thought of that. He rarely sticks to one topic. His academic background is in geology, being a 1966 graduate of Oxford. He stuck with that for about a year before embarking on what would become an amazing career in journalism. It took him almost no time at all to be named Britain's Journalist of the Year in 1971. He's covered everything from the Troubles in Ireland to Watergate to a very personal involvement in the Falklands War. Just happened to be there when the invasion took place. Subsequently, he spent 3 months in a jail in Tierra del Fuego. That is a different story. By this time, he had published 3 books, but it was his 1998 Professor and the Madman, as it was titled in the U.S., an account of the creation of the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, that went on to sell millions, even though his publisher only printed 10,000 at the outset. Since then, he's written about, you name it, he's written about earthquakes, volcanoes, outposts of the former British colony, and now 300 examples of an exquisite collection of skulls. Yeah, there may be more than one question in your own skulls about his latest work. We're very happy to welcome to the Commonwealth Club once again, ladies and gentlemen, Simon Winchester.
Thank you very much indeed. One of the bizarre things about writing a book like this is that people bring you things to identify. And this happened the other day in Portland. I was about to give a talk, and a woman came up with me with an enormous brown paper bag and took out of it a large skull with horns, I mean, very big horns. And she said, I've had this in my garage for a long time. What is it? And I said, it's obvious what it is to me. I'm no great expert on skulls, although I suppose I know a little bit more about them today than I used to. But it's an elk. And she went away well satisfied. But I went away particularly satisfied because she gave me the ability to tell a short story, which is sort of vaguely relevant to this part of the world. Not terribly relevant to skulls, but it's a very good way, I think, of breaking the ice. Not that this audience seems particularly difficult, but let me briefly tell you the story and then we'll get into the meat of the matter. It was 1980 and I was at the time living in New York, and I got a call from a newspaper in London saying, would I go immediately to Washington State, where Mount St. Helens was about to erupt, and interview Harry Truman, who you may all remember was the curator of the Spirit Lake Lodge near the summit of St. Helens. So it was about, the mountain actually blew on the 18th of May, and this was about the 14th of May. It was pretty dangerous. So, plus Dixie Lee Ray, the governor of the state of Washington, had imposed a very serious ban on anyone going to the summit, but we thought, you know, we were British and we didn't quite understand these regulations. So we flew to Portland, rented a car, drove to Longview, turned right, up the road towards the summit, and we're confronted after about 3 or 4 miles by an enormous barrier, which we could see vague sort of tracks on either to the left and the right of it, and decided we could, you know, with a bit of gumption, get through the forest in the car. So we did, and bounced back onto the blacktop a little way up from the barrier. And then about another 3 miles, there was a much more serious barrier with barbed wire on the top and a skull and crossbones. So there is actually a skull connection here. And this time, this one did not look passable. So, but nonetheless, I sort of discerned on the left-hand side a vague track through the woods. So, and I thought, well, it wasn't my car, so what the heck, let's belong to Mr. and Mrs. Hertz. So the photographer climbed over the barrier, and it was, I might say, the mountain was in a very unstable condition. The road, it was like going up and down like your ship at sea, and there were sort of fumaroles with steam and so forth. So we wanted to get in and out as quickly as possible. So I rather recklessly drove to the left of the barrier, down in a ditch and then up the other side, and there was a great bang, and the car stuck absolutely firmly solid with its sump wedged onto a tree stump that I had failed to see and would neither move backwards or forwards. So I thought, well, I want this to be on the radio, so I won't say what we were, but we were in trouble, should I say. So I got out of the car, left it in the forest, and walked up to meet the photographer, and we walked up the blacktop on this swaying, very unstable road, and eventually met Harry Truman, and he was this cantankerous old man living there with his 16 cats, determined not to leave, well, no matter what. The mountain, he said, was never going to explode. This was a myth. He'd lived there since 1927, a very, very long time, and he was lived there. He was going to die on the mountain. Well, of course he did, as it happened, just 4 days later. So anyway, we interviewed him, we took his photograph, we did everything that we needed for the paper, and headed back down the hill and came to the barrier, and on the other side of it there was, with his lights flashing, a policeman. And this policeman had clearly suffered a serious sense of humour failure, because he said, what on earth are you doing here? He said, you shouldn't, there's a ban, you know, fines, prison, all the rest of it, you're under arrest. So, all right, he said, well, first of all, we've got to get this car out of the way. So we're going to call a tow truck from Longview, and it'll cost at least $1,000 in cash, because they don't like coming up here. So we agreed, and up came this tow truck about an hour later, the policeman not saying a word. He couldn't have been less friendly and cooperative. And the tow truck came, picked very easily, having accepted $1,000 in cash from the photographer and me, dumped the car onto the road and left, hightailed it down the hill again. And the policeman said, right, the deal is this. I'm going to get into my car. You are going to follow me. We'll get to the Longview police station where you'll be booked and arraigned and appear in court, and basically you're in trouble. So we thought, well, what an adventure. So we took off down the hill, and using a key to the padlock, he unlocked the lower barrier, and we followed him through. He locked it again, and we proceeded on down. And then, after about a mile further, he stopped the car and got out with a rifle in his hand. And I thought, I mean, it was only trespassing, for God's sake. But this is America, you know, but they do things differently here. So we were rather worried, but he came up and he said, no, don't worry. I have just seen in the forest on the right an elk. That's the connection. I've seen an elk. And it is out of season, but I would like to shoot it. But the thing is that it's impossible to carry an elk on top of a police car with that gantry of lights. It is also unseemly, and I would probably lose my job. So the deal is this. If you will agree, if I'm successful, to lash the elk to the top of your car, then we'll forget all about it. And that's exactly what happened. The photographer and I sat in the car. There was an explosion. And the policeman gestured to us, come on quickly. And we went and hauled this enormous dead creature out of the woods. He had some string and stuff, and we hauled it on top of the car, put its legs inside the windows, tied it, and drove down, not to the police station, but to his wife's house. And we unloaded the elk in the garage, and then we had a cup of tea, and he dismissed all charges. So, thank you very much. But anyway, look, the serious business is about skulls. And this all came about in about 3 years ago, when I had a telephone call from a friend of mine in London called Max Whitby, who's a former BBC producer who now has a company that makes apps. And he said, Simon, what I want you to do is to read today's Daily Mail. Now, the Daily Mail, as you probably know, British tabloid, spectacularly unreliable. It's not one of the worst. It's didn't receive much of the attentions of the Leveson inquiry just finished, but it's a pretty unreliable, inaccurate, sensational newspaper, but the most popular newspaper in the world, in the English language, on the internet. He said, read it and look for a story about a man called Alan Dudley. And it turns out that this chap, Alan Dudley, collects skulls and has the most remarkable collection imaginable. He is, and it always amazes me, the kind of jobs people have. He lives in a city called Coventry, an extremely dull industrial city in the English Midlands. He's lived there for many, many years. And his job for the last 30 or so years has been to select the veneers that go on the dashboards of Jaguar motor cars. So if any of you in this audience have, or outside in the world, have a Jaguar, sit in it and admire the burled walnut, it was selected by this man, Alan Dudley. But like sort of all British school children growing up, he collected newts and tadpoles and watched the television programs made by this great British national treasure, David Attenborough. And he was particularly as a teenager fascinated by wildlife of one sort or another. And one day his life essentially changed when he saw by the side of the road a fox, a red fox body. And he thought, I'd like to do a taxonomic preservation of this. I like to stuff it. And so he picked it up and he saw, sadly, that it had obviously been hit by a car or something, and it had many broken ribs and a big gash in its side, and it wasn't really going to be amenable to taxidermy. But then, and this shows how Alan Dudley is somewhat different from the rest of it, he thought, I know, I'll cut off its head and I will look at its skull. And so that's what he did. And not much of this talk is going to be grotesque, except the subject as a whole, you might say, is rather macabre. But the only detail here is what he then did. He took the fox's head, and with his penknife, he scraped off the fur and the underlying muscles and removed the tongue and the eyeballs and things like that, and eventually got himself a really rather beautiful thing, a fox's skull, which when the fur and everything is removed from it, is a thing of some considerable beauty. And he looked at all the various components of it. He read up on it how the bottom part is the mandible and the upper part, the brain case, the cranium. And the front of it is the rostrum, which could be a beak or a bill or a nose or, in our case, a face. And the thing that below the eye sockets called the arches that are effectively the cheekbones, and then the auditory bulli in the back, which are big or small depending on how keen the animal is on hearing, and then the ridge at the very top of the back of its head called the sagittal ridge, that is where the muscles come from that open and close the jaws. And he became fascinated by this and decided that he would, having collected one, he would collect more. And so he collected a few days later and similarly prepared with his penknife a newt, which has also a rather different shape, a rather more delicate mandible, a smaller rostrum, big eyes, the arches a little bit less developed than those of the fox. And then he got a fish from the fishmongers and found a different kind of structure, much more delicate bones or cartilages, but essentially the same structure. And he thought to himself that he was going to collect skulls. This would be his hobby. Well, as with many people I've met over the past few weeks talking about this book, they normally stop when they have 60 or 70 skulls. And he had got to about 70 or 75 skulls by the time he was about 25 or 26 and married and had two children. But the problem was that it's the way you prepare the skulls, because some of them are extremely delicate. A lot of them have very, very fine bones inside the nose, for instance. Clearly the penknife way is not a very good way of preparing a delicate skull. The other traditional way is to let loose on the skull thousands of maggots. You immerse them in a tub of maggots or domestic beetles. But the trouble with that is that the maggots are often so happy to see all this flesh that they've just been presented with that they have a sort of feeding frenzy, an elbow. I don't know if maggots have elbows or not, but they sort of elbow each other out of the way. And in this frenzy, they disturb and dislodge and break and damage some of the more delicate bones. So what Alan in the end decided was to do the most sort of primitive of cleansing of a skull, known as cold water maceration, which you put it in a bucket of cold water and you leave it there for many months. And the bacteria in the water, or the ones that settle on the surface, they do the work for him that he would have done with the penknife or the maggots. Trouble is, the water turns jet black and it really smells absolutely dreadful. And it was during this period that his wife left him. And so poor old Alan, he didn't have a wife now, and he had an increasing number of skulls, but he did have a spare bedroom. And he put into this spare bedroom this collection, which he rapidly accelerated in size until it grew to what it is today, which is about 2,500 skulls, all kept in the bedroom of this house in Coventry in England. And yet he's unsung. At the time I met him, I flew to, after Max's telephone call, I flew to London, rented a car, went up to Coventry, as I say, this rather ordinary English Midland city, went to this row of extremely anonymous houses in suburban Coventry, had the wrong number of the house, found I was actually next door to where Alan Dudley lived, and I said to the man who answered the door, "Are you Alan Dudley?" He said, "No." I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, do you know Mr. Dudley?" He said, no. "How long have you lived here?" I said. He said, "I've lived here 40 years. I said, "Well, actually, I'm sorry, I got your number wrong. He's actually next door, and he's lived there for 35 years. He said, "Well, I've never met him. We're very private people in England." I said, "Not only is he your next-door neighbour, but he has the biggest collection of skulls anywhere in the world." And he was astonished. He said, "I had no idea." So no one knew about this chap, except that they came to know about him because of the reason that Max Whitby had called in the first place. The reason he was in the Daily Mail is that he had gotten into trouble. On the 4th, I think it was, of March 2008, he was getting up for another day of veneer choosing and skull collecting when there was a rap on the door, and he went downstairs in his dressing gown to find four policemen standing there. They identified themselves. There was one from the Customs and Excise Department. There was one from the Wildlife Protection Department who had come all the way down from Edinburgh. And there were two uniformed policemen, not armed, of course, because this was Britain, in case the situation turned ugly, which was most unlikely. I mean, Alan is an extremely gentle, retiring sort of chap. And they said, "Mr. Dudley, we have reason to believe that you have a number of skulls in your possession, which you shouldn't have under the Convention on the International Trafficking of Endangered Species. So I'm afraid you have to sit down in your kitchen while we go upstairs to your former wife's bedroom and examine this collection." So they went upstairs all day, and they came down rather triumphantly just after lunch and said, "We have indeed found five things that you shouldn't have. There's a howler monkey from Ecuador. There's a particular type of marmoset called the Goldie's marmoset. There was a chimpanzee. There was a kind of penguin. And there was a tiger. And all five of these," they said, "are highly illegal, and you shouldn't have them." So they did a number of things. They charged him formally. They put an ankle bracelet on him. And it was sufficiently carefully calibrated that he couldn't leave the city of Coventry. But he also, they put crime scene tape around the entrance to his former wife's bedroom. He couldn't go in the bedroom to look at his skulls. And when I turned up, he was effusive and happy, but he showed me his ankle bracelet and said that, "I'm afraid, Simon, I'd love you to see the collection. You can go and see it." So I ducked under the crime scene tape, and I would hand him skulls and say, "What is that?" And he'd say, "That's a walrus, or that's a narwhal, or that's a sardine, or whatever." And all of which, I must say, he has. But I can't go in, because if I went in, then police cars would arrive, and I'd get into even more trouble than I'm in at the moment. So eventually he went to court. It turns out, I mean, this was all because of the internet, and specifically because of the howler monkey. They had found the wildlife protection people in Edinburgh who scan the internet for this kind of crime all the time. They had found that they had seen three howler monkey skulls for sale, two of them with bullet holes in the heads, suggesting that they had been hunted by poachers. The one that Alan took had no bullet hole in it, but nonetheless, this wasn't a particularly good excuse. And the judge, you know, gave him a fairly severe wigging. He pleaded guilty because he knew that he had technically committed an offence, and they fined him £2,500, I think it was. They confiscated the five skulls, and they sentenced him to 2 years in prison, but with the sentence suspended for 2 years, so that if he doesn't do it again. So we decided, having looked at this amazing collection of about 3,000 skulls, the thing about it was that it was taxonomically impeccable. I mean, there are, tens of millions of species of creatures on this planet. A mere 58,000 species are chordates, you know, have skulls. And of those, they're divided into five classes: the mammals, the birds, the reptiles, the amphibians, and the fishes. And Alan has a very good and comprehensive collection in each of those classes. He's now been doing it for, well, the better part of 35 years. And he's regarded as a great authority. And so an awful lot of his specimens, for instance, come from zoos. When I was there, a zoo rang up from the English Midlands, and we've got a hippopotamus, he said, that's feeling a bit unwell, and we think it's probably not going to last for another week. So when it pops its clogs, as we say in England, will you take away the head and put it in presumably a very big bucket of water for a few months? And he doesn't date much, does Alan Dudley. So he's always got these baths with... And so we decided to make this app for the iPad. And this, incidentally, is an interesting paradigm shift, if I can use that rather overused phrase, because this is a book which has been made from an app. We did the app first of all, whereas it's normally the other way around. So this is part of the future, I think, of publishing. So we made a fairly careful list illustrating all these animals in this extraordinary collection, and using the iPad you can do all sorts of extraordinary things with them. You can examine them and expand them and compare them and rotate them. And anyway, the technological aspect of this presentation is quite remarkable. But what I wanted to do was to look a little bit beyond that, not just at the collection itself, but how skulls generally fit into human society. Why do we revere the skull? Why are we so interested particularly in the skull? And we have done so for donkey's years. I mean, go back to the oldest grave sites in the world, thousands of years old, and people didn't revere, let's say, the rib cage, which you might argue that they did, because it, after all, houses the lungs and the heart, or the pelvis they didn't revere. That's, after all, through which birth occurs. Even the longest bones in the body, that say the femur, that wasn't particularly revered by the ancients, but the head always was, even though they didn't really know what the grey matter that it enclosed did. There was this feeling right from the very start that this brain matter was where the soul, the personality of the person resided, and so that whatever protected it, this hard thing that surrounded and protected it, was in some way special. Plus, it looked like the human being or the animal that it originally represented. And so we wanted to take this notion of the importance of the skull in human society and examine it in some detail. And what I thought I'd try to do this evening is to look at a number of aspects of the skull and how it fits into human society generally. And one of the fields is I was interested in the skull in art. Now, artists have long drawn the skull and done all sorts of things with it. Leonardo, Dürer particularly, was very interested. But the picture that I want to look at, I mean, Van Gogh did this extraordinary one that I dare say could be used for anti-smoking commercials of a skull with a cigarette in it. And there's a wonderful Aztec skull in, I believe, the British Museum, made of malachite and with fool's gold eyes. And it's a beautiful thing which fits on the face of someone, sort of warrior's mask. But the picture that really fascinates me is the enormous, it's in the National Gallery in London. It's huge, it's 7 feet square, it's painted on wood, on oak, in oil, and it was done by Holbein, and it's called The Ambassadors. And there are a number of extraordinary things. It's a portrait of two men. It's the chap on the left of the picture, if you go and see it, is called Jean de Danteville, who was the French ambassador at the time to London. And his friend, who is on the right of the picture, is a chap called Georges de Selve. And if you are lucky enough to go and see the picture, that they look fairly middle-aged. In fact, Jean de Danteville is 25, and Georges de Selve is 29, so they didn't wear terribly well back in those days, which was the 1530s. This was painted, we know the date that it represents, because just by de Selve's left hand is a sort of cylinder, a sort of astrolabe device, which actually you can read, if you can decode it, the precise date that this depicts, which is the 4th of April, 1533, which is Good Friday, 1533. And the fact that it's Good Friday is significant because the picture is full of devices which illustrate the religious turmoil that was going on in Britain at the time. This was just a few days or weeks, after all, after Henry VIII divorced Anne Boleyn and massively ticked off the Pope, Clement VII, I think it was. And this resulted, of course, in the schism between the Roman and the Protestant Church, which led to the establishment of the Church of England, the Anglican Communion. And the picture is full of artistic devices of one sort or another, done by Hans Holbein. There's a lute with a broken string, which suggests a schism, something that needs repairing. There's a globe, which has Rome at its centre, but there's an open book, which has the writings of Martin Luther, the great German Protestant. So everything about the picture suggests turmoil going on within the church, which was what de Danteville wanted. But what de Danteville also wanted, he was a very serious man, is that he wanted Holbein to illustrate in some way the fact that however wealthy these two were, and once again, if you see the picture, de Danteville is clad in a very formal ermine robe. They're clearly wealthy men. However distinguished and aristocratic and wealthy they may be, they are ultimately going to die. So there should be a memento mori, a reminder of death in the painting. And Holbein did something very, very clever. If you look at the picture, you'll see at the very bottom of it in the National Gallery this what looks like a smear, a diagonal smear moving from the bottom left to the centre right of the painting. And this is what's called an anamorphosis. And an anamorphosis is the kind of thing that you see in a football game. It is, if you look at the picture from a certain angle, it turns from being a smear into a fully formed skull. It's an extraordinary piece of painterly cleverness. And he had arranged that the painting is at the top of a spiral staircase in Jean de Danteville's house, so that as you went up the staircase, so your perspective changes, and what was a smear turns into this remarkable and rather beautiful skull illuminated from the left. So I do urge you to, next time you go to London, go and have a look at this remarkable painting, and you have to do, but everyone else is doing it, you kneel down in front of it and look from a bizarre angle, and suddenly this skull will appear in front of you. So I thought that was one rather interesting aspect, the skull in art. But then there are other things. Science, for instance, and I've been long fascinated by how the skull can be misused by scientists. In the early 1900s, there was this American biologist, Morton, I think his name was, who developed the science of craniometry, measuring thousands of skulls that he had access to, and deciding that there were different types, different shapes of skulls, from which there was a human hierarchy of existence. For instance, very crudely, two types of skulls which you see in dogs, for instance, dolichocephalic skulls, which are rather elongated skulls, rather like the elk that lady handed me in Portland, or brachycephalic skulls, which are sort of flattened skulls that you see of an animal like a bulldog. Well, this chap Morton, who was very much a eugenicist and a racial supremacist as well, said that these skull types show a hierarchy within the human race, such that the dolichocephalic skulls of the Aryan shows it has racial and moral superiority to the brachycephalic skull of the Jewish person. This, of course, was seized upon by the Third Reich in the 1930s and used as one of the many scientific justifications for the policies of the Nazi government in the 1930s and 1940s. And similarly, the same thing happened using the same craniometric measurements for the apartheid apologists in the 1950s in South Africa. So the pseudoscience that attaches to skulls has been used for a long time for very wicked ends, but it's also been used for rather risible ends. And what I want to talk about a little bit is the science of phrenology, which is a very, very much a pseudoscience. It's complete poppycock. It was invented by a couple of German scientists in the 1850s who declared, they started off relatively reasonably, that certain parts of the brain are responsible for certain aspects of a human's personality or proclivities. If you were good, for instance, at calculation, then that might be part of the brain above your left eye. If you were an old lecher, then your lecherousness would be at the back right of your head. If you were particularly honest, it would be a development of your frontal lobes. If you were, you had what they called Witterwiffness, only a German could come up with that name, then that love for life would be in the back right of your head. Where they started making a mistake is that they said that if you're particularly good or endowed with this, your brain will swell, so you'll get a bulge in your brain. But where they really went off the rails is to say that then your skull will change shape to accommodate the bulge underneath, and that will be possible to detect by someone with very, very delicate fingers feeling the outside of your head. I mean, this is complete nonsense. The skull basically is, once you're grown up, you know, you're no longer a child's skull, which is very flexible. Our skulls are very solid indeed, and the idea that a brain can expand and cause something to bulge out is nonsense. But this didn't stop this man, Fowler, somewhat unscrupulous man in London, opening very near the offices of the Daily Mail, it has to be said, in Fleet Street, a consulting rooms where he published a booklet about the 39 areas, the bulges I can potentially feel in your head, and he would invite people on payment of 2 guineas a time, a not insubstantial sum in the 1880s, to come and be felt by his delicate fingers, and they would be told that you have particular proclivities. There, no suggestion that he could cure you by sort of pushing your head down and moving the bulge from one part of your head to another. But this went on for quite a number of years until another doctor pointed out quite cogently in a paper published in the 1890s that this was arrant nonsense. And the interesting thing is that this doctor is well known to you all for a completely different reason, nothing to do with medicine, because it was Peter Mark Roget of Roget's Thesaurus. And he published a paper saying that this man Fowler was a complete charlatan, a very rich charlatan by now, it should be said, but forced him to close down the business and scuttle off back to the shires. And Roget had the last laugh, because if you look at phrenology now in Roget's Thesaurus, you'll see it's up there with palmistry and astrology as one of the scientific nonsenses that briefly flourished in Victorian England. So that's one of the areas of science that I became fascinated by. But there's another, and this is something that I'm sure you'll find very familiar, which is the story of Piltdown Man. The skull of Piltdown Man has been in the British Museum in London since 1912, I think. And it came about in a rather extraordinary way. A man called Charles Dawson, who was a lawyer who lived in Sussex, a very sort of pompous, a very, very ambitious man who wanted to be known and recognized by history, used to portraits of him in velvet suits with breeches and a tricorn hat and a sword and spurs and things. I mean, this is, you know, early 20th century England. Wouldn't think you'd get too many customers as a lawyer, but nonetheless. He was also an amateur archaeologist, and he was walking one day in 1908 in a quarry close to his house when he came across the fragments of a skull. And he thought, this is clearly a hominid, it's clearly an adult human being, but it's got a very small brain case. And so possibly it has monkey-like, ape-like features, which at the time was a very interesting thing to say, because Darwin had written The Origin of Species just 50 years before 1859. The world was in, Teilhard de Chardin had found Peking man. There was a general acceptance among the intelligentsia that humankind had somehow descended from or was somehow associated with the ape. But what everyone was looking for was the missing link, some creature that showed features of being both human and ape-like. And this was a possibility. So Dawson took these fragments up to London to the British Museum. The head of the geology department, a chap called Arthur Woodward, who very serious and revered man, never in 42 years took a single day off work except half a day when he broke his arm. That was the only liberality he allowed himself. He very excitedly came down to Sussex, and the two of them hunted in this quarry for several weeks and found another and much better cranium, and they found a jawbone which was clearly ape-like and they found a couple of molar teeth, which suggested that this creature, if it was all of one creature, had a fairly omnivorous diet, didn't have a sort of primitive ape-like diet. So he worked on this, did Dawson, for a long time, and then in 1912 assembled all the great and the good of the geological world and announced that they had found the missing link. And this paper said that the missing link, 975,000 years old, proved incontrovertibly that mankind had descended from the ape. And wasn't it wonderful, said Woodward to the audience, that the missing link was an Englishman. I mean, he was a Sussex gentleman. This was the apotheosis, the climax of the British Empire. How wonderful that. So it was called, he called it, in honour of the man who first discovered it, Eoanthropus Dawsonii, and it was on a pride of place in the British Museum for the next 40 years, the missing link. However, in the 1950s, enough other evidence had been accumulating, suggesting that this was probably unlikely. And so the skull was given, they'd given permission to analyse it. Particularly, they'd come to realise that nowadays, that a skull that's been buried for a long time absorbs the chemical fluorine. Well, they tested this skull. It had virtually no fluorine in it at all. So clearly, they smelled a rat. They analysed it more carefully. And they found that the three parts, the hominid was a 50,000-year-old, probably from Germany, fairly standard fossil of a small human being. The jawbone was that of an orang-utang from Sarawak. It had been dyed with potassium bichromate to make it look orangey-brown colour. And the teeth, when looked at under a microscope, had got little bits of metal in them, showing that they had been filed down by a machine. So the whole thing was a monstrous hoax. But who had perpetrated the hoax? Well, initially, they discounted Woodward because he was a figure of such rectitude. They thought possibly it was Arthur Conan Doyle, who was a nearby neighbour, and they thought he had a sort of puckish sense of humour. It's the sort of thing that Sherlock Holmes might have done. They thought Teilhard de Chardin, who had a house nearby and had a sort of axe to grind, might have had, but they dismissed that after a little while. And then they looked at Charles Dawson's own personal collection. Both men had now died, and there was a huge memorial to Dawson for being such a hero. But when they looked at his collection, the heroism somewhat evaporated, because they found that he was a habitual forger and hoaxer. They found all sorts of things in his house, a Chinese bronze urn, which was neither Chinese nor bronze, an elephant bone scapular tool, which had been cut with an electric bandsaw. So he was, if you like, the Jason Blair of archaeology. He was a thoroughly bad hat. And so they removed the Piltdown skull from Pride of Place and put it in the storeroom in the back. And it's now very, very difficult to see because the British Museum is embarrassed. And, of course, we, it's sad to say, the missing link is not an Englishman, never was and never will be. And the final thing, moving away from science, I wanted to look at is just to tell you a little personal story about a chap that I became rather interested in. I wrote a book about the Balkans in the late 1990s. I covered the invasion of Kosovo and became fascinated with the Turkish vizier who had led the siege of Vienna in 1683. You'll remember that the Ottoman Empire was trying to expand into the Holy Roman Empire, and they were on their way to Rome, and they stopped at Vienna. And 300,000 Ottomans besieged the city for almost a year, I think it was. And there are these two nice sort of gastronomic aspects to the story that just before the siege was lifted, everyone inside the walls, very, very hungry and miserable, the bakers were down preparing the last few loaves of bread for the starving people. And they were 4 o'clock in the morning baking the bread, and they heard noises beneath the ovens, which they, the bakers, thought probably sounded like tunnelling. And maybe these beastly Ottomans were trying to get in under the walls. So they alerted the sentries, who indeed did see Ottoman or Janissaries trying to get under the walls, so they did whatever they normally do, you know, pouring boiling oil on them or something, and they scampered off. And then a couple of days later, the massed armies of the Poles and the Swedes came down, as they had been asked to do, and relieved the siege, and the siege was over. So the authorities in Vienna now said that among the people who had helped relieve the siege were these noble bakers, and so they gave them the privilege thereafter of baking rolls in the shape of the Islamic crescent, which is the birth of the croissant. It's not as French as the French might care to think. So when next tomorrow morning you have your morning croissant, remember it's the hero bakers of Vienna that brought it to you. Well, the Turks were then in full retreat, and they ended up in Budapest a few days later. And it was at that point that what always happens when a Turkish vizier loses a battle is that the Sultan, in this case Mehmed IV, sent a note saying, "Well, I'm terribly sorry you've lost the battle, so I'm afraid you've got to be executed. How would you like to be executed?" And he said, "Well, it's very nice of you to give me a choice. I would like to be strangled." And they said, "Fine, well, we'll send the court strangler." The Ottomans and the Chinese both had court stranglers. So they brought him up from Istanbul, and the traditional way of doing it is with the string of a bow, which they wrapped around his neck, and it takes about 30 minutes. You squeeze, and then, I know it's horrible, squeeze, let go, squeeze. It takes about 30 minutes for a good strangler to do his job. And then this chap, not a very attractive chap at the best of times, and a very bad human being as well, was dead. They chopped off his head, they took it down for the Sultan to inspect to make sure they'd got the right fellow, and then they returned it to Budapest, buried the head and the body together. So I wanted to do this book. What I should say then happened is that a couple of years later, the Viennese in hot pursuit got themselves to Budapest, and chasing the Turks into Bulgaria and then back into Turkey, and they found the grave of this man who had been so impertinent as to besiege them, and they dug him up and said, "We're going to have the skull. You can take the body back to Turkey, but we'll have the skull and put it on display in a museum in Vienna, the Stadtmuseum." And there it remained ever since, whereas the body was taken back to Turkey. And I decided in writing this book that I would make a journey through the Balkans from the two polar ends of it, from Vienna to Istanbul, and symbolically, maybe conceitedly or stupidly, I thought it would be an interesting sort of literary conceit to go from seeing the skull of Kara Mustafa Pasha to the body of Kara Mustafa Pasha. That would be my journey. So I wrote to the director of the museum in Vienna and said what I was doing and could I come and see the skull. And he wrote back very politely and said, "I'm afraid you can't, because in 1972 the Turks had a big sort of outburst of nationalistic fervor, and they went after two countries who they said had somewhat dishonored them. First of all, they went to the Japanese. And the Turkish ambassador in Tokyo went to the foreign ministry and said, "It is outrageous, in our opinion, that you should call brothels in Japan Turkish baths. So can you change the name?" Every chap that wanted to go to such an establishment would always look for the word Turku. And so the Japanese said yes. And from now on, I'm sure none of you wish to know, you probably do know, they've changed them to Soaparanda, Soapland. So if any of you want to see that, don't think you're going to get a good washing. Other things will happen to you. So round one to the Turks in Japan, and they then went to the Austrians and said the same thing. "We think it is outrageous that you have the skull, the head of a former grand vizier of our army, on display for people to gawp at in your museum in Vienna. So will you take it away?" And the director said, "No, you can't have it back, but we'll take it off display and we'll put it in the basement." So, said the director to me, "You can't see it, but you can come and argue your case, if you like, if you come to Vienna, and maybe I'll let you see it." So I went down there, and it was just like an Oxford tutorial. There was this pipe-smoking, tweedy Austrian man in a huge book-lined study. And I sort of rather pathetically, because I didn't know the details of the story in sufficient detail for true intellectual rigor, had to put my case. But evidently it worked, because after about 20 minutes, he reached over and pressed a button and called in a secretary. And this lady came in and he said, "Fraulein, would you please take this distinguished gentleman downstairs to meet our other distinguished gentleman?" So I went downstairs and there was a cardboard box with "Herr K. Mustafa" written on the side in ballpoint pen. And a chap opened up the sellotape and opened up the box and pulled out this vitrine. And in it was this skull of the the Grand Vizier of the Ottoman army of 1683. Extremely ugly, with a few strands of hair, five yellow teeth, and most remarkably, the bowstring still round his neck after nearly 400 years. I wasn't able to take photographs, but it was a marvellous starting point for the book. And in the end, I also got to find the body, or didn't see the body, but I saw the grave. And that's the other sort of gastronomic aspect of this story, because it's in a town called Giresun in eastern Anatolia. Giresun used to be called Caressus, and it is the town where the first cherry trees were grown. So if at breakfast tomorrow you have croissants with cherry jam, you've got the whole Balkan story, really, on your breakfast plate. So I thought that was quite amusing. As a coda to the story, I wrote to the director the other day when we were preparing the book, and I said, how is the skull doing? Is he still in his box? And he said, no, when you wrote that book in 19, I think it was published in 2000, it created such a fuss. All sorts of people were coming to the museum to ask to go downstairs and look at the bowstring and the teeth and all the rest of it. That one night a previous director, there have been three or four directors since 1999, one rainy night he took it upon himself to bury it in an unmarked grave in a cemetery that everyone's forgotten. So somewhere in Austrian soil lies the skull of the Grand Vizier of the Ottoman army, but no one's saying exactly where, because they'd like everyone to forget it. Well, then one final thing to say is, I often ask Alan, going back to his collection, what if there was a fire, what creature would he save from the fire? And his most precious possession out of his 3,000 skulls is a two-headed cow, which he got from a zoo. And he says all the other wonderful things, and there's some extraordinary skulls, beautiful birds. I like the spoonbills and the curlews. I love the various marine animals that he's got, the narwhal, which has a tusk which only grows out of the left-hand side of its head. It's one of the strange peculiarities. But of all the things he loves most of all is the two-headed cow from somewhere in the English Cotswolds, I think. So with that, thank you very much indeed. Any questions, I'd be delighted to try and answer them.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Simon Winchester, noted author, journalist, and broadcaster. His latest book is entitled Skulls, and we are going to take questions from the audience. And we'll begin with one with an audience member who says that her brother is a heavy metal musician and has most of his wardrobe covered in skulls. He also dons a lot of silver skull jewelry. He's a new father. He carries a diaper bag with a skull and crossbone appliques. How do you explain the current pop culture fascination with the skull and crossbones icon?
We go into this in great detail in the book and in the app, and I find it truly fascinating how, for instance, how lighthearted is the Mexican approach to skulls. I mean, in the middle of November, they have this Feast of the Dead. They make spun sugar skulls. And then we have the Grateful Dead, and we have motorcycle gangs, and we have armies. I mean, the SS in Germany, of course, very seriously used a death's head mask in their skulls. The skull as a symbol of power, the skull as a symbol of danger on poison bottles. One of the things I found it particularly fascinating, for instance, that doesn't really answer your question totally, is the US Department of Energy, for a long time, has been trying to come up with a danger symbol that they can put outside the nuclear waste depository that they're building, or they hope one day to build, in Yucca Flats in southern Nevada. Because the waste there will remain lethal for thousands of years, probably longer than we have been on this planet. We should, nowadays, if this was going to be dangerous for 20 years or 100 years or maybe 200 years, probably put a skull and crossbones. But who's to say that in 10,000 years the skull and crossbones will be a symbol of danger? And who knows? It may be like Mexico. I mean, maybe you'd think, oh, a skull, that's interesting. Let's go and visit it. It must be fun. So and the competition is ongoing. So if you were to go to the Department of Energy website, you can take part in this. And there are all sorts of very inventive thoughts. And the one that I like most of all is to put no warning at all But after the years go by, a number of people go to this place and die. And so you'll just see an ever-increasing number of dead bodies lying in the desert, and that will make people think, oh, perhaps I'll go somewhere else.
You know, in The Final Problem, the Arthur Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes story, one of the things that Moriarty wants to do, the evil genius Moriarty, one of the first things he wants to do when he meets Sherlock Holmes for the first time, he wants to run his hands along Sherlock Holmes' skull. And he said, until the original becomes available, I'd love to take measurements of it. Now, this is a guy, Arthur Conan Doyle, medical doctor, scientist, and he wrote that story around 1893. So did the study of phrenology have some cachet with people who are actually educated scientists?
Oh, yes. I mean, it certainly did. And skulls were collected as curios. Phrenology diagrams were collected. People would look at them and think, there is some sense in this, but only some sense. And they are extremely beautiful. I mean, the phrenological models that you can find in antique shops today are things of great beauty, which reminds me of that lovely story of someone at about that time going into an antique shop in London that specialized in the trading of skulls. And in it was a skull, very expensive, which purported, according to the antique dealer, to be the skull of, I think, and I may not have the name correct, but an English monarch, let's say William IV, who came just before Queen Victoria. So eventually a price was agreed on, and the man wrote a check and walked out of the antique shop holding this precious relic of King William IV, his skull. And just before he left the door, he noticed on beside him, also on a sort of pedestal, another much smaller skull, which looked very similar to the one he was carrying out. And he said to the antique dealer, what is that? And he said, oh, that's also William IV, but when he was a baby.
Question from an audience member. What is the most unique reaction you've had subsequent to the publication of what you even yourself have characterized as this somewhat macabre topic of skulls?
I think people have been somewhat surprised, somewhat alarmed, I think. They knew, a lot of my friends knew that years ago I had, in order actually to come to America in the first place in 1962, I took a year off between school and university and took a job working in a mortuary in North London, cutting up people, I mean, dead people. So I think that they I hasten to believe they were dead. Anyway, they certainly were when I'd finished with them. And all sorts of extraordinary stories I could tell perhaps on another location from this. But I think a lot of my more sceptical friends drew a sort of line from that in 1962 to now, 2012, what, 40 or 50 years later, to think that I've always had this slightly macabre side to me. I haven't. It's a pure coincidence, and this is not why I was chosen for the project, but I think they disbelieve me and think I'm a deeply sinister human being.
Well, speaking of this man who had such an extensive collection that it moved you to write a book about it was such a fascinating collection, what is Alan Dudley like?
He's staggeringly ordinary. I mean, this is, you would never think, if you met him in the fish shop, you'd think, well, where he would be buying a skull, of course. you would think nothing of him. He's a very nice, gentle man. This is a classic example of the amateur scientist and the value of the amateur scientist, which is generally these days discounted. Occasionally we hear, don't we, of amateur astronomers who somehow see some nebula or something going off and you bless their existence. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a similar sort of chap. I mean, he has done this without any public recognition for years, has assembled a collection which is taxonomically impeccable. He will give it ultimately to probably the University of Warwick when he dies. He's lost a wife as a result. He can't date as a result. And you might think he was sad, but he's not. He's a cheerful, joyful chap who goes to work every day and then settles down rather like a stamp collector might take great joy from looking at a penny black or whatever. He would get a curlew or a capybara and think, oh, beautiful thing. And like these Chinese jade collectors who would just hold a little jade, like the hare with amber eyes, and just sort of stroke it. He will be seen of a night doing that to a curlew skull and beats me, but he's a very nice chap.
when will he be allowed to actually step back into his skull collection physically?
Oh, he is now. No, the when they find him and they ordered that he could remove the ankle bracelet and the crime scene tape was taken away from the from his former wife's bedroom, and he now is and has total access. And he thought it was ironic that the first animal that he was given by a zoo to prepare to turn into a skull after having these five confiscated and after the fine and after all the embarrassment of having to, which is very embarrassing, as Martha Stewart knows only too well, having to wear an ankle, well, she would find it sort of interrupts her fashion statement. Alan wouldn't care too much about that. But the first animal that he was given was a tiger, a Siberian tiger. But that, of course, came from a zoo. The one that he got from came from a dealer in Moscow, and that that troubled them. But the same animal, and but that was legitimate, whereas the previous one was very non-legitimate.
An audience member wants to know, we've got about 100 people, I guess, here tonight. Are there any people in the audience that collect skulls? Oh, wow. A couple. Oh, and you're also a geologist. Okay, so there are a couple of audience members.
I might say one thing, if I can, that when I talk about the phrenology, and sometimes I show a diagram of a phrenological model, and you can see if you blow it up that over the left eye is where the phrenologists identified the ability at mathematics. And I would say something casually like, and if you have a bulge over your left eye, it means you're good at mathematics. You'll see people starting to rub their left eye. And I would say, I can see you. I know you're pretending just to scratch your nose, but I know you're feeling in the hope that you can balance your checkbook.
That's funny. You know, if you collect American coins, the Holy Grail is the 1909 SVDB penny. If you're into radios, cattle and radios fetch a high price. If you're collecting skulls, what's the holy grail of a skull collector?
Well, a saber-toothed cat, I think. So this would be a fossil skull with these enormous jaws. I mean, that I think, is one which is very, very difficult to get hold of. And also some of these extraordinary snakes, the Gaboon viper, which he does have, which have, and think about, I mean, when I was talking about how the maggots will destroy in their feeding frenzy, some of the delicate bones, they have these teeth which have these exquisite channels which, I don't know if it's the spitting, the Gaboon viper or the spitting Gaboon, one of them has this little angle in the teeth which allows it to spit the poison out at you and unerringly in your eyes. I mean, they're so brilliant, but you only really recognize their brilliance when you look at the skulls. And when Alan demonstrated that to me, I mean, I could see where his passion came from, because this is nature red in tooth and claw, if you like, and yet the exquisiteness of them and the variety. I mean, what could be more different from a skull of a hippopotamus and the skull of a sardine? And yet they're both there, and they're both in his collection, a demonstration of the extraordinary wealth of variety in the animal kingdom.
When you were deciding to actually pursue this as a book, which is a significant investment of time on your part, this is the largest private collection on Earth, right?
We believe so, unless the gentleman in the audience has a larger collection. But yes, we haven't been challenged so far.
Why did you, at that point, why didn't you say, well, this is a fascinating topic, I'm going to go to the museum that has the largest collection, period. Why did you decide to focus on this?
Well, one of the reasons was that we wanted to make the app, which meant that we needed to take every skull and put it on a turntable and to turn it through 720 half-degree rotations and take very high-definition photographs of it, use an algorithm that would allow us to blow those pictures up and reduce them. No museum would give you the time. I mean, even the Field Museum in Chicago, they would find that very exasperating. This took about a year of hard photographic work. And we had all sorts of problems with one skull in particular that you may be familiar with, and that's Damien Hirst's. I wish it was Damien Hirst's skull. It was a skull in his collection called For the Love of God, which he covered with platinum and then with 8,500 diamonds, so that he could then auction it to make it, if people bid £57 million for it, the most expensive artwork in modern times. In fact, nobody did bid for it, and he had to form a consortium and buy it back for himself. We took photographs of it, but he said when he saw it that the photographs weren't sparkly enough. I mean, it looked like 8,500 diamonds on a skull. So we took it back to Chicago, or rather we took the photograph back to Chicago, wrote an algorithm which increases the sparkliness of diamonds added it to each of these 8,500 diamonds, which took several weeks, but he still decided it wasn't sparkly enough, so we then stopped arguing with him and withdrew it. So when you, I do apologize, ladies and gentlemen, when you look at this book, it does not have Damien Hirst's skull in it. I don't think it diminishes the collection much, but I'm nonetheless sorry for the sake of completeness.
What is the name of the app, by the way?
It's called Skulls by Simon Winchester. No, it's got those four words, but I think Skulls would probably do it.
Okay, great. Yeah, do you get it at the App Store?
You go to the App Store and hand over, I believe, $14.99, yes. And it takes, it's about 680 megabytes, so it's a good idea to download it when you go to bed at night, and it'll be there with your morning croissant and cherry jam.
Looking at this fellow's collection of skulls, did it inspire you to collect anything?
No, although I have been a stamp collector all my life. I collect the stamps from Hankou, the treaty port in China, which had its own postage stamps for about 20 years. So laboriously and slowly I've built up the collection. I haven't got all that many, but there weren't a huge number to begin with. So I do collect things. Yes.
Okay. And you approach Alan Dudley, you look at the collection, ordinary house in Coventry, doesn't know his neighbor. You see the skull collection, you think, wow, I think I could write a book about this. What topics, what characteristics do certain topics have where you say, interesting, I am not going to write a book about this?
Well, if I can answer it the other way around first of all, because I'll have to think about what you've just said, is that a lot of what I do are about unsung heroes, people that are little known, but have done something magical and wonderful, have altered the course of human society in some sort of way. And the trajectory of their personal lives has been interesting. I mean, the divorce, I know we sort of laughed about it, but it's actually very sad. And so William Smith, W.C. Minor, all of these people, Joseph Needham, who I wrote a book about, a Cambridge scholar involved in China, all had these remarkable lives, did something astonishing, and yet are relatively unsung. And I think that dear old Alan Dudley falls into that category. So I think a self-promoting charlatan. I would never want to write a book about Mr. Fowler and the phrenology, because he's too full of himself, I think.
I see. Is there ever a book that you've really spent a significant amount of time on, a subject, where you had to give it up?
Oh, yes. It was a book. I had this idea once that Manchuria was the cockpit of the world. I mean, this was, after all, the place that started the war between Japan and China in the 1930s. And I liked Manchuria, which consists of these three northeast Chinese provinces, Jilin, Liaoning. And Liaoning, particularly up on the Amur River, very, very cold, very beautiful. I loved it. And I spent a lot of time there writing notes and researching and meeting people, and in the end I just thought there wasn't a book there, and even if there was, that absolutely no one would buy it. I mean, who wants a book on Manchuria? Very few people. So I asked the publisher and he said, forget it.
Okay. And unfortunately we've only got 2 minutes left, which means we've only got time for about one more question. If you are that skull collector in search of the saber tooth, or in search of perhaps human skulls, where do you go?
To find them?
Or to get them, if you actually want to secure it. Do you go to eBay?
No. I mean, there are dealers all over the world, some less scrupulous than others. There's a big museum in Oklahoma City, for instance. There are dealers in New York, in London, in Paris. In Paris, there are a lot of forgeries, and you'll be aware of the crystal skulls, that chap with the hat. I can never remember his name, the films. Indiana Jones, thank you very much, the chap
Indiana
with the hat.
Jones, by the way.
Sorry. I mean, the crystal skulls, nearly all of them, which purport to be Aztec or Mayan, are not. They're made by a French forger who lived briefly in New York. They're beautiful, beautiful things, but nonetheless, only the ones that are genuine are very crude and ugly. But the beautiful ones, yes, you can find those in specialized auction houses, but, you know, caveat emptor, there's a lot of forgery in that world.
I can imagine. And you've got to be, as Alan Dudley has proven, rather careful about what you secure.
Very scrupulous, because there'll be the ever-watchful people from the Wildlife Department, police who will come down from Edinburgh at a stroke and fit you up, as they say, and you'll be in jail quite quickly.
On the other hand, if that never had happened, you would never have heard about him.
It's an ill wind that blows nobody any good.
Simon Winchester, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Simon Winchester, noted author, journalist, and broadcaster. His latest book is Skulls, an exploration of Alan Dudley's curious collection. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind everybody that copies of Mr. Winchester's new book are on sale in the lobby. He'll be pleased to sign them in this room immediately following the program. I'm Brian Hackney, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Really well done.